Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Susan Truitt, co-founder of the Ohio Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections, who discusses the ongoing effort to investigate the multitude of irregularities reported in the presidential election in the state of Ohio. James Paul, executive director of the Global Policy Forum, who discusses significant new proposals to reform the structure of the United Nations Security Council. And media critic Jeff Cohen, who reflects on the career of the late investigative reporter Gary Webb, whose work documented the link between cocaine trafficking in the U.S. and the CIA-backed Nicaraguan Contra Army during the 1980s. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The British aid and development agency Oxfam reports that 45 million children across the globe are at risk of dying in the near future because wealthy nations have not lived up to their aid commitments. In an increasingly globalized economy, the industrialized group of seven, or G7 nations, have cut in half their budget for developmental aid compared to levels allocated in 1960. The G7 nations are falling far short of their 1970 promise to spend 0.7% of their gross domestic product on developmental aid. So far, only Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and the Netherlands and Luxembourg have kept this promise. In contrast, the U.S. spends only 0.14% of its economy on developmental assistance, last among the G7 nations. The low level of actual aid among industrialized nations endangers the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which pledge to cut global poverty in half by the year 2015. In addition, Oxfam says poor countries in 2003 paid $39 billion in debt service, while only getting $27 billion in new developmental aid. The burden falls most heavily on Africa's impoverished nations, where payments for debt service exceed spending on health care. In what is being billed as a goodwill gesture, the Israeli government of Ariel Sharon is set to free 170 Palestinian prisoners. The prisoner release was announced as talks began between Sharon and the Labor Party to form a new coalition government, followed by Egypt's release of Azam Azam, an Israeli Arab, on December 5th, who served 8 years in prison for spying. Six Egyptians were also set free in the exchange. The prisoners released are made up mostly of members of Fatah, the political faction of the interim Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. The announcement was also aimed at sending a signal to Abbas of the potential for future prisoner releases if the Palestinian Authority cracks down on Islamic militants. According to the Associated Press, Israel holds 7,000 Palestinian prisoners, most of whom are charged with security offenses. Radi Jarir, a Palestinian minister for prisoner affairs, called the release cosmetic, noting there were no negotiations with Palestinian leaders about prisoners. Ironically, the announcement of the prisoner release came at the end of a two-day Israeli incursion into a Gaza refugee camp that killed 11 Palestinians. On New Year's Day 2005, China will celebrate by flexing its economic muscle by opening 3,000 new textile and apparel factories. The plants will open as global textile trade quotas expire, giving China unlimited access to the U.S. retail market, putting millions of jobs at risk in the U.S. and in developing nations. Almost overnight, China could single-handedly dominate the world's $220 billion garment trade. According to American Prospect magazine, China could easily control half of the U.S. textile and apparel market, with the possibility of 30 million jobs vanishing in the U.S., Turkey, Mexico, Indonesia, and other emerging nations. In early November, the Bush administration accepted five petitions calling for extended quotas on Chinese imports of textiles. The administration has 90 days to respond and is facing conflicting pressures from garment manufacturers and big-box retailers who favor the cheaper goods. China is the world's largest exporter of consumer clothing, with over 7 million garment workers. The nation has exploited its low labor costs with a mix of modern technology for flexible production that is favored by America's big-box retailers like Walmart. Labor activists say China represses independent organizing and ignores worker rights. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
As problems continue to surface related to the November 2nd presidential election in Ohio, a recount of the votes began, as requested by the Green and Libertarian parties. On another front, a lawsuit was filed with Ohio's Supreme Court contesting the validity of the state's election results based on documented cases of voter suppression, miscounts of thousands of votes, and a pattern of shortages of voting machines in predominantly African-American precincts. Meanwhile, evidence of sloppy supervision of the election recount, even possible vote tampering, was brought to the attention of Representative John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, who is conducting an ad hoc House Judiciary Committee hearing in Ohio. Cheryl Eaton is Deputy Director of Elections for Ohio's Hocking County. She signed an affidavit that described how a technician with Triad Governmental Services, the company that wrote the software operating punch card voting machines in 41 of Ohio's 88 counties, dismantled Hocking County's tabulation computer days before the recount began and put a patch on it. But the Triad company asserts that their employee wasn't tampering with the voting machine, but merely repairing it in advance of the recount. Voting rights activists, however, point out that it's inappropriate for private companies to have access to the machinery of elections that could provide unscrupulous parties with an opportunity to manipulate election results. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Susan Truitt, co-founder of the Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections, who discusses the ongoing effort to investigate the multitude of irregularities reported in the November 2nd presidential election in the state of Ohio.
Well, our statisticians and sort of the tally analysis that we did came up with a rather amazing anomaly in the vote count in Ohio. And particularly, that was that the race between Ellen Connolly, who was a jurist from Cuyahoga County, and she's a Democrat, she ran against Moyers for the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court position. And although she lost the race, she received more votes than the top of the ticket, John Kerry, in about 15 counties in Ohio, most notably in the southwestern part of the state around Cincinnati, where she is least known. It raised huge issues as to how that is possible, and we feel that it is not. And we have statistical analyses that these experts are saying that what has happened is that votes were taken from Kerry in those counties and given to Bush.
Do you see something concrete coming out that might resemble a smoking gun? Because that's certainly what everybody's looking for, right? I'm sure you are, and everyone around the country is concerned about this issue. Does such a thing exist, and do you think it will be found in this case?
Well, it's our position that the statistical analysis and the vote tallies themselves are the smoking gun in Ohio. We also have just innumerable accounts of problems in the vote count in many, many different counties, not the least of which is Perry County, where they had more votes than actual voters, you know, and just all the incidents that we are well familiar with, the Gahanna incident of 3,000 votes for George Bush in a precinct where there were only 600 or so registered voters. These are just the stories that have cropped up all over the state.
Do you think the recount effort specifically, will it be viewed as credible, given Kenneth Blackwell's role, his dual role of being a Bush supporter and chair of the re-election committee, and at the same time overseeing these elections?
I think that the recount effort, which the Green Party has undertaken, I think of them as American heroes for taking this on, is a great effort on their part. What we've seen happening in the recount is that although it's supposed to be random selection of precincts, they are predetermined precincts for the most part, and that's of great concern. Another great concern, of course, are the myriad reports of manipulation of the tabulating machines in these pre-selected precincts prior to the recount. It's of such great concern that the Green Party, through John Bonifaz, as well as the Kerry Edwards campaign, have filed motions in federal court to stop the tampering. I mean, this is outrageous, the reports that we're receiving.
Maybe you can describe what the Triad company and some other company officials have done in the interim between the election and the recount.
Well, the Triad company We have many different reports, most notably in Hawking County, but other counties as well, where prior to the recount, precincts are selected, and then triad employees go into the counties and are seen taking tabulators apart, putting new pieces and parts into tabulators. And, in fact, one of the employees allegedly was quoted as saying that he wanted to know which precincts were being selected for the recount because he wanted to make sure that the tally came out correctly so they would not have to engage in a hand recount. Now, when you hear things like that from credible witnesses, there is nothing short of outrage that can be the reaction. Triad employees, I think, are trying to present explanations, but what they can't deny is that many of their employees have been in these precincts, in the boards of elections, manipulating tabulators prior to the recount.
Susan, what is your overall goal and involvement in investigating the irregularities in the November 2nd election? What do you hope will come out of this?
Well, it's my hope that the fraud that we feel is inherent in this Ohio election 2004 will be uncovered, that it will get national press, that people would become aware of the major and very, very dangerous issues that are in our election systems in this country, not just in Ohio. There is a pattern of disenfranchisement. There is a pattern of vote suppression of African Americans. There is a pattern of manipulation of the vote tallies. And unfortunately, we live in a time where people want the answers now. And for us to assume that we can have an accurate vote count the night of or the day after an election is a fallacy that needs to be cleared up. My whole point and purpose in all of this is to dissect this election, to expose what has happened, and to prevent it from ever happening again.
That was Susan Truitt, co-founder of the Ohio Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections. For more information, visit the Alliance website at www.caseohio.org or Free Press, the Ohio-based online investigative magazine, at www.freepress.org. For more than a month, the U.S. news media has been focused on allegations of corruption at the United Nations-run Oil for Food program that operated in Iraq from 1996 until the U.S. invaded Iraq in March 2003. An investigation is being conducted by the U.N. itself, while several committees in the United States Congress are also examining evidence of mismanagement and fraud that reportedly funneled billions of dollars to Saddam Hussein. That story has largely overshadowed a set of important recommendations made for reforming the United Nations put forward in early December by a committee appointed by embattled UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. The world body has seen significant geopolitical changes since its founding after World War II, which are not reflected in its current structure. One of the key recommendations is to expand membership of the powerful UN Security Council, which sets aside only 5 permanent seats for the U.S., Russia, Great Britain, France, and China, with a rotating group of 10 additional members. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with James Paul, executive director of the Global Policy Forum, with its office near the U.N. in New York City. The group's mission is to monitor policymaking at the United Nations, promote accountability of global decisions, educate and mobilize for global citizen participation, and promote issues vital to international peace and justice. Paul discusses the need for reform to strengthen the world body, not weaken it, as many conservatives in the U.S. are advocating.
It's almost a standard assumption that the Security Council should be enlarged, there should be more so-called representation of the various regions of the world, particularly the countries of the global south, should be better represented on the council. There's a lot of literature that shows that when bodies pass beyond a size approximately 15 or 16, they develop some kind of executive committee inside. And so I don't think enlargement is going to really be in the interest of smaller states or better representation. It's actually going to lead the way to a small executive committee of the big powers. That's the danger that most people aren't talking about, but it's there. Another thing is that member states now, when they come on the council, they pretend that they represent their region, but in fact they represent themselves and none other. And so the real challenge is to develop better regional mechanisms so as to have representation. That's the way the council could be strengthened, is to keep it small but have a much more regionally coordinated input.
What should be the role of nation states in the UN?
The world is evolving very rapidly, and there is a question as to what the role of nation states, in fact, is going to be at a time when there are international organizations of various kinds that trump the nation state, the World Trade Organization, for instance, the IMF, and so on, and also regional organizations that also trump, to some extent, nation state, and that's particularly true in Europe. So it's a funny institution. It's somewhere between the Congress of Vienna, where the great powers coming together in Europe to decide the future of, you know, European security or whatever, and some future thing that may well be a worldwide parliament. And it's sort of stumbling along between the past and the future. Institutional reforms can't make it right now what it needs to be because the international system is still very chaotic and still dominated, especially dominated by one very powerful country, and that's the United States of America. And there's huge differences of income and well-being between the peoples of the world. So it's a very chaotic, extremely unjust world, and it's very hard to imagine an institution developing in this particular world that's going to be anything close to what we would like it to be.
Well, does anyone have a vision for how this world body could operate effectively and equitably?
There's constant pressure on the UN to make various different kinds of reforms that are moderate in extent but moving in the right direction. Some of the most exciting, of course, the International Criminal Court is a very, very interesting development. The U.S. hates that. There are a lot of interesting proposals having to do with the development of global taxes, which is considered in the U.S. Congress to be just absolutely, you know, impossibly radical, and they're very opposed to it.
Can you make any connection between how the U.N. is structured and some of the unsavory things that U.N. troops have done, such as raping civilians in a number of different countries, or on a policy level, supporting the current unelected government of Haiti?
Well, there's several issues here. One has to do with whether or not U.N. peacekeeping is sometimes ends up being used to support illegitimate great power interests. In the case you're referring to in Haiti, this is certainly true. It was a coup that was brought off by the United States and France with Canadian complicity, and the UN peacekeeping force down there, for better or for worse, is involved with that initially illegitimate process of overthrowing Aristide. Secondly, though, the issue of, say, sexual abuse by peacekeepers has something to do with the fact that it's the richest countries who have the most disciplined armies. They're not always as disciplined as we would want them to be, but the point is they're much better trained and they're much better equipped and they're much better officered and so on. And they don't send their armies to the UN. So the UN peacekeeping forces are often made up of rather badly trained and not well officered forces, and those are more likely to be involved in these kind of abusive acts. Furthermore, because of the arrangements between nation states and the UN, in which the nation states insist on maintaining their national sovereignty, the UN doesn't have the capacity to bring these soldiers to justice. And so they have essentially impunity. It's up to the individual country to discipline them, and they very often don't. So this, it just all these things show how short we are of the kind of international order that we need desperately in this period.
That was James Paul of the Global Policy Forum, which can be reached by calling area code 212-557-3161 or visit the group's website at www.globalpolicy.org. Investigative journalist Gary Webb, whose controversial series of articles in the San Jose Mercury News documenting the link between cocaine trafficking in the U.S. and the CIA-backed Nicaraguan Contra Army, was found dead in his Sacramento, California home on December 10th. Police say the reporter had committed suicide. Webb's 1996 articles asserted that the CIA-supported rebel army financed itself through the drug trade, leading to a crack cocaine epidemic in Los Angeles during the 1980s. The series of articles were among the first to be widely circulated on the Internet, which sparked anger in African-American communities across the country and a demand for congressional hearings. However, Webb's Contra cocaine articles were refuted by government officials and aggressively attacked by some of the nation's most prominent newspapers. Eventually, the San Jose Mercury News withdrew its support from Webb and reassigned him to a satellite bureau. Webb quit in 1997 and wrote a book about his investigation titled Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion, published in 1999. An internal investigation into the charges conducted by the CIA's Inspector General in 1998 corroborated much of what Webb had reported and confirmed that the agency had been made aware of the Contras' drug trafficking activities. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with columnist and media critic Jeff Cohen, who reflects on Gary Webb's career and how this reporter's tragic story reveals much about the crisis in U.S. journalism today.
Gary had years of experience as an investigative writer at Cleveland Plain Dealer and then the San Jose Mercury News, and he was actually on the team of reporters that won the Pulitzer Prize. In 1995-96, he came across a major story that had come out in dribs and drabs beginning in 1985, that the CIA-organized Nicaraguan right-wing Contra Army was helping to finance his activities by importing cocaine into the United States. Gary came upon a specific drug ring that was headed by two Nicaraguans, and they were running drugs into this country, taking some of the profits and giving them to the CIA's army, the Nicaraguan Contras. The thing that Gary Webb added was he was able to focus specific attention on this drug ring, and he got law enforcement officers and court transcripts, people saying that this Nicaraguan Contra-related drug ring was protected against prosecution, against probes, on the basis of national security. In other words, the CIA was protecting these guys. And Gary Webb traced these drug traffickers to a very important early crack dealer named Freeway Ricky Ross. And Freeway Ricky Ross supplied crack in the early 80s to Los Angeles and other cities. He was very closely connected to the Crips gang and the Bloods gang. While the story had originally been broken as early as 1985 by Bob Perry and Brian Barger in AP, every time there was information that got out that the CIA's army, the group that Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, had referred to as the moral equivalent of our founding fathers, every time that story had gotten out over the years, the mainstream national press tried to push that story back into the box. And it was sort of dead for a period of years until Gary Webb was able not only to identify drug traffickers that were close to the Contras, giving some of their profits to the Contras, but he was able to trace the cocaine to the streets of Los Angeles and other cities where numbers of people were getting addicted to crack who probably would not have been addicted to crack except that the CIA was protecting individual drug dealers because they were helping or connected to the Contras.
Jeff Cohen, this had quite an impact on the ground. I know that the African-American communities in Los Angeles were activated in large part because of Gary Webb's investigative reporting on this topic, really looking at government complicity in the scourge of drug abuse and the violence that really took hold around the country in urban centers all over this nation. You want to speak to that because yeah. It wasn't just an abstract piece of research. This really had real-world implications, real-world impact.
Because of the web, it was sort of the first explosive piece of journalism that got out to perhaps a few million people around the gatekeepers of the traditional media. Black community groups started raising questions. Congress members like Maxine Waters demanded federal hearings and federal investigation. And the irony is when a few weeks later, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times, when they started savaging Gary Webb, they didn't know that the upsurge in the wake of Gary Webb's reporting for the San Jose Mercury, that that was going to lead to federal investigations where the CIA Inspector General investigated the charges and the Justice Department's Inspector General, and they basically, years later, revealed pretty explosive things that vindicated in many ways what Gary Webb had written back in 1996.
What is this case study of an investigative journalist being attacked by major media outlets who really did very little in the way of the investigative reporting that Gary did on this topic? What does that say about the media system that we live under here?
It says that a number of these national outlets are more protective of power and protective of the state than they are interested in getting at the facts and the realities on the ground. Gary Webb wasn't confined by entrenched power, entrenched ideology. He had an incredible story of CIA protection of drug traffickers, and he was going to follow it no matter where it went. And Gary Webb was the target of a triple-barreled attack in the Washington Post, New York Times, and L.A. Times. The laughable part of it was the L.A. Times, because Gary Webb traced some of the contra cocaine to the streets of Los Angeles, and obviously the L.A. Times missed the story. Not only did these three major dailies knock Gary Webb out of mainstream journalism, the attack on Gary Webb was so massive that ultimately Sepos, the managing editor at the San Jose Mercury News, sold out Gary Webb. They sent him to journalistic Siberia. They forced him to quit, and they drove him out of mainstream journalism. And ultimately, I think, they ended up driving him to his death. I refer to it as certainly one of the most ferocious media attacks on any reporter in recent history. And Gary Webb just never rebounded from it. It's one of the saddest chapters in the history of mainstream journalism. And the chapter ended a couple weeks ago when Gary Webb apparently took his own life.
That was columnist Jeff Cohen, the founder of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Read his article, R.I.P. Gary Webb, Unembedded Reporter, online at www.jeffcohen.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.